you say why? Why the perfect murder?
Oh, aye. It can't be detected. That's what he said. It leaves no trace at all, just dissolves into the blood.
And what did your son say to you, Mrs. Marshall?
He said, I know Alice has tried to poison me.
He opened the door and found himself in the hands of two murderous brutes. Then he was dragged back into the parlour and this time murdered.
Murder Most Foul. 6 forensic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 6, The Bloody Thumbprint.
Mr. Farrer, sir, it's half eight, sir. Mrs. Farrer, is Mr. Farrer all right? It's Willie Jones.
What's up, Willie?
Well, you ain't opened up, Mr. Kent. I saw through the letterbox. This thing's knocked over.
You're right, something's up. Can you get through this back window, Willie?
The back window? Yeah, I'll have a try.
Go through my shop, then go out the back. I'll stay here.
Right you are then, Mr. Kent.
Hello, Mr. Kent.
Oh, hello, Joe.
Farrer not opened up yet. It's not like him.
No, I think something's gone wrong in there.
Have they had heart attack? They're not young.
No, just...
Farrer told me he was 71. She's younger, but not much.
Willie has gone to get through the back window.
He's small enough to do just that, he is.
I didn't think Mrs. Farrer was looking too good the other day.
I thought she were ale and hearty enough.
Mr. Kent! Oh, my God!
Mr. Farrer's lying on the floor, covered in blood.
Willie Jones's discovery of murder took place on Monday, the 27th of March, 1905. The body was in an oil and paint shop which the Farrows managed at Deptford High Street in South London. By 9:30 that morning, the local police were on the scene in the shape of Sergeant Atkinson and a couple of constables. The sergeant found Mr. Farrow battered to death in the back parlour, and next door, his wife unconscious in her bed after an equally ferocious beating. He sent for the police doctor and had his constables ask the local residents if they'd seen anything suspicious. By the time he'd done so, Sir Melville McNaughton, an assistant commissioner at Scotland Yard, had arrived with Detective Inspector Fred Fox. Meanwhile, outside the shop, another police official was entertaining the crowd.
Scotland Yard detective, and if you don't all move along now, I'll have you all locked up.
You're the one who's going to be locked up, me lad. Come along now. Come on.
There's a lot of drunkenness in these parts, Sir Melville.
At this time of day, Fox?
The cattle market pub's open at 5, I believe. Half a mile away. Now, the dead man was found in the back parlour.
There's some blood here, in the shop, I see.
Oh, they must have been getting their attack here, Sir Melville.
They? Not just one man?
Oh, nearly always two on this sort of crime, I've found. Oh, here we are.
My God. I gave him a hammering, Fox. Blood everywhere.
I wonder if they took the weapon away with them.
Heavy blunt instrument, eh?
Ah, this is Sergeant Atkinson of the local station, Sir Melville.
Sir, you arrived here sharpish. Good work, Sergeant.
And what have you there, Atkinson?
A couple of stocking masks, Inspector, made out of ordinary black stockings. No sign of a weapon.
And Mrs. Farrow?
The doc should be here soon, Sir Melville, but she looks bad. Very bad. I wonder she's still breathing.
Oh, they probably thought they'd killed her. No signs of a break-in, are there?
They wouldn't have had to, sir. Old Farrow used to open up before 8:30 so the workmen could buy paint.
I suppose the motive was robbery.
There's a cash box by the bed, what's been forced open. Willie Jones, the shop assistant, reckons there's about £11 in it, pounds in it, Sir Melville.
Sergeant!
Ah, yes, Constable.
Got some witnesses outside, sir.
Ah.
Milkman and his boy saw two men leaving the shop about 7:15. Thought they were workmen. And Mr. Purfield said he saw the door open about 7 and an old man covered in blood look out, then close the door.
A man covered in blood and he did nothing about it?
There's lots of slaughterhouses round here, sir, so you often see men with blood on them.
Mm. An old man. Must have been Farrah. So he got to the door and got pulled back in, I suppose, and finished off.
And, Sergeant,
yeah.
Three people saw two men belting for all they was worth up the high street before 8 o'clock.
Oh.
PC Nelson's taking statements, sir.
Good, Blunt.
Well done. Let's have a look at this cash box, shall we?
The Metropolitan Police now was a very different force to that which had existed in the last two decades of the 19th century. The Ripper murders of 1888 had shown the Yard to be mismanaged and thoroughly disorganised. There'd been a big reform of the CID, a forensic division had been established, and a fingerprinting section had been formed.
Oh, the poor woman.
Yeah.
They must have felt sure she was dead.
If she pulls through, we'll know who did it, Inspector.
See, here. Fox, Sergeant, look.
Yeah.
On the lid. You see?
I do. It's a thumbprint in blood. Oh. A beauty. Clear as daylight. Oh, thank you for spotting it, Sir Melville. I'll take it back to the Yard and get Charlie Cullions onto it.
It could be Farrow's thumb or his missus, Inspector, if they were protecting the box.
Yeah, it could be. Well, I'll take their prints and those of Jones. He could have picked the box up when he came in. I've got my fingerprinting stuff in a cab outside.
So, for the first time in the United Kingdom, fingerprints were taken of a dead man's hands and those of a dying woman's too. Indeed, Mrs. Farrow finally expired a few days later. At the Yard, Inspector Charles Collins checked the bloody thumbprint against the 80,000-odd prints that he'd already filed, but without success. And it didn't match the Farrow's prints, nor Willie Jones's, who discovered the crime. Meanwhile, from the fairly vague descriptions of the men seen leaving the shop by the milkman and his boy, and by those who saw two men running down the high street, Sergeant Atkinson had a hunch. The description sounded like two brothers, Alfred and Albert Stratton, well known to his men as nasty customers, who'd suddenly departed their usual haunts. He went to have a word with Alfred's girl, Hannah Cromarty, and found her in a state of near panic.
I don't want no trouble, Sergeant, because I don't know nothing about it, see? But Alf went out by the back door that morning, just after 6, and came in the same way about 8, puffing and blowing.
Did he say what he'd been up to, Hannah?
Well, no, he told me to say he'd been here till 9. Changed his coat, and funny thing, he put black polish on his brown boots. And then he cleared off, scarpered.
Did you see his face? Was it clean?
Yeah, it were clean, because he just washed it. It were wet.
Where's his brother Albert hang out, do you know?
Down in Warwick Street, I think at Mrs. Tedman's place.
You won't have any trouble, Hannah. Put your mind at rest.
Albert? He's been a bad lad, has he, Sergeant?
I'd like to talk to him, Mrs. Tedman.
Wild. He's wild. That's his trouble. And his brother is no better.
And you've not seen him since early on the 27th?
Yes. He went about 9, changing his coat and putting blacking on his boots. I said, why do you do that? And he said, to mind my own business.
Thanks, Mrs. Tedman. We'll look out for him.
He has friends up the Jamaica Road. Pub keepers. Name of Hislop.
Hislop? Oh, Hislop.
Yes, Hislop.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Tedman.
Tell you this, Sergeant.
Yeah.
Last week, under his mattress, I found 2 stocking masks.
What? Oh, stocking masks. Are they still there?
No, I looked this morning. 2 stocking masks under the mattress.
Sergeant Atkinson reported to Sir Melville and Inspector Fox, adding that the odd behaviour with the boots perhaps made sense, since the witnesses described the men running down the high street as wearing brown boots, which were uncommon, and brown coats, which they'd left behind them. It was decided that the Strattons should be apprehended. The only hard evidence was the bloody thumbprint, but if it matched one of the two brothers' prints, it would be the first time such evidence was tested in a British court. The brothers were finally apprehended next Sunday evening in the King of Prussia pub by Detective Sergeant Beavis and the aptly named Sergeant Sargent of the local force. They were brought before the magistrate at Tower Bridge. Both were in bad humour.
What you got against us, Mr. Beak?
The charge will be laid by Inspector Fox. Inspector.
I have no charge at the present, sir. We wish, though, to have both men remain in custody for the present.
You ain't got no bloody evidence!
I don't believe a word Mrs. Lisping Tedman told you, the old cow.
Quiet! Quiet! You will not do your case any good by such behaviour. Inspector Fox, have you witnesses identifying these two men at or near the scene of the crime?
A milkman and his boy saw two men leaving the shop in question at about 7:15 that morning, sir, who resembled Alfred and Albert Stratton. Others saw two men running down the high street who they think were the two brothers.
Well, they want their eyes testing.
Dave the milk can't see across the bleeding road.
The court will be adjourned for 30 minutes.
We've got alibis.
We was with our girls.
We was never near the Farrow shop.
We was innocent as the Pope.
Innocent, I swear it on our mother's grave.
Although the case against the Strattons was pretty thin, the magistrate was prevailed upon to have them held in custody for a week, and that gave Fox the chance to get their prints, something Alfred and Albert objected to no end.
Prints? What of? Our noses?
I ain't going to put my pinkies on any flaming pad.
It's only a new routine, lads. Regulations.
Fingerprinted, Alf. Routine my arse.
Not on your Nelly, Inspector.
Sit in your hands, Alf.
Now, look, lads. It's for your own good.
Our good? How?
Look, there's prints all over the Farrow's place, so if you're as innocent as you say, this will prove it.
We was never near the shop.
Yeah, there'll be no prints of our digits there, will there, Burr?
No, you're right, Alf.
Then let me help you prove you're innocent.
What do we have to do, then?
Just put four fingers and your thumb on the pad. So.
Maybe the Strattons didn't grasp the significance of fingerprints. Maybe they'd been wearing gloves, which one of them took off to force the cash box. At any rate, they gave Fox what he wanted. Back at the yard, a day or so later, Fox and the assistant commissioner called into Inspector Charles Collins' fingerprint section.
We've come with bated breath, Inspector Collins.
So well you might, Sir Melville.
Now, come on, Charlie, what's the verdict?
If you'd be so kind as to come over here, I'll show you. This is the thumbprint made in blood found on the catch box. I've had it enlarged, you see. Blown up is what the photographic boys call it. Now, this print, next to it, is Albert's thumbs, right hand, left hand. Compare the ridges, the way they're laid out, the distance between each ridge, the falls in the centre, and the number of them.
Yeah, they're quite different, aren't they?
Uh-huh.
I'd say they were. The cash box print has more ridges, for one thing. And the halls, as you call them, are wider apart.
Right, Sir Melville. Now, here's the blow-up of Alfred's thumbs. My bet was that the bloody thumb was the right-hand one, so here's Alfred's right thumbprint. What do you see?
They're the same. Dead ringer.
They are, aren't they, Charlie?
I'd go into the witness box and argue for them. There's 11 points where the two prints correspond, and that's one chance in a few million.
This thumbprint evidence was sufficient to persuade a magistrate that the police had a case. And on the 5th of May 1905, Alfred and Albert Stratton stood in the box at the Old Bailey, charged with the murders of Thomas Farrow and his wife, Mary Ann Farrow.
Be upstanding!
On your feet, Albert, and you, Alfred.
The judge had the mellifluous name Sir Arthur Moseley Channel, and the prosecution was led by Richard Muir, QC. He opened the case against the brothers with a dramatic account of the early morning of Monday, March the 27th, in the Deptford Oil and Paint Shop.
Thomas Farrow was up by 6 that morning, leaving his wife still sleeping. A dark morning. We know he made himself some tea and was drinking it when someone knocked on the shop door. Now, this wasn't an unusual occurrence. The men on their way to work who required paint and such like would often knock on the door before 8:30. So Mr. Farrow put down his cup of tea and went, as he believed, to let a working man in. He opened the door and found himself in the hands of two murderous brutes who bundled him into his parlour and battered him but not yet to death, for while no doubt they were knocking a terrified Mrs. Farrow senseless, Farrow staggered to the shop door and opened it, and was seen by a witness to stand in the door a moment with a vacant look on his face. And no wonder. Then he was dragged back into the parlour and this time murdered. The murderers stole the contents of the cash box, about £11 in all, forcing the cash box open to do so, and leaving behind one very important clue, which the Crown will come to in due course.
Muir called his witnesses to the stand, beginning with Willie Jones, who was followed by Sergeant Atkinson, Detective Inspector Fox, and then Sir Melville McNaughton.
So, by the bedside of the dying woman, you found a cash box which had been forced open.
That is so. It was empty.
Did you notice anything in particular about this cash box?
There was blood on it, and a mark which resembled a thumbprint made in the blood.
A bloody thumbprint, in fact.
Yes.
What happened next, Sir Melville?
Inspector Fox and myself considered this could be of help in tracing the murderers. However, Sergeant Atkinson, quite rightly, pointed out that the thumbprint could be of the dead man or his dying wife.
But this didn't prove to be so.
No. Inspector Fox took the thumbprints of Mr. and Mrs. Farrow. They did not match the thumbprint on the cash box.
Thank you, Sir Melville. That is all of this witness, Millard.
Has the defence any questions for this witness?
If you please, Millard.
Go ahead, Mr. Porter.
Sir Melville, you say the thumbprints of the victims did not match that on the cash box.
Yes, that's correct.
Why are you so sure this is so?
Why? We gave them to our fingerprint experts at Scotland Yard, along with the cash box, and they photographed them, then enlarged them, blown up, it's called. They were quite different from the bloody thumbprint.
I see. The experts at Scotland Yard decided this. Thank you, Sir Melville. No further questions, my lord.
This must have been the first indication to the prosecution of the way the wind was to blow in the Stratton brothers' defence. Fingerprints had been used for 1,000 years by illiterate communities in Asia as an alternative to signatures. But the individuality of fingertips was only pointed out in the West by the scientist Galton in 1885, and there was still some controversy as to their infallibility and also a dispute over different methods of classification. Following Sir Melville, Hannah Cromarty gave her evidence as best she could, and then the court was treated to some light relief by Sarah Tedman.
So you found these two stocking masks under Albert Stratton's mattress. What was your reaction, Mrs. Tedman?
Well, I said to myself, two stocking masks? So what is he up to? But I didn't ask him because he's a wild devil and I didn't want to be strangled or something.
Thank you, Mrs. Tedman. No further questions, m'lad.
Mr. Porter?
If it pleases, m'lad.
Can I go now, please?
Not yet. I wish also to ask you some questions.
I see.
Why did you look under Albert Stratton's mattress?
Why did I look under his mattress?
Yes. Why?
Well, I was just looking.
Well, perhaps you were looking for something. Try to remember.
What something?
Money. People have been known to keep money under a mattress.
Well, he owed me 2 weeks' rent, and I was making his bed.
You
so
old cow! No further questions, Clarence and Ford.
The defence saw, of course, that the thumbprint was the only tangible evidence. And no jury would find Alfred guilty because of it, and Albert not. So they concentrated their fire on the fallibility of that thumbprint, producing firstly an expert witness, Henry Folds.
So you were teaching physiology to medical students in Tokyo, Japan, Mr. Folds. When was this?
Years ago. 1870 to about 1882. I can't remember precisely.
And how did your interest in fingerprints begin?
I collected Japanese pottery, and the Nippon potters often left their fingerprints on the pots they'd made for identification, you understand. And, of course, I noticed how each hand of prints was different. It was obvious, couldn't be missed.
When was this?
1880, 5 years before Galton's paper. I wrote to the journal Nature in 1881 suggesting it would be a way of identifying criminals. No one took any notice, only a man called Herschel. He wrote to Nature to say that when he was a magistrate in Calcutta in 1858, he took the prints of illiterate Indians to identify them.
Now, Mr. Foles...
What Herschel was suggesting, of course, was he'd found out about each fingerprint's individuality a long time before I did, when we had nothing but his word for it, whereas I had my ports.
Mr. Foles, Mallard has a question.
By fingerprints, I take it you include the thumbprint?
Yes, Mallard, I do. The thumb makes a very distinctive print.
The clerk of the court will pass Exhibit C to you, Mr. Foles, the enlarged photographs of the bloody thumbprint and of Alfred Stratton's right-hand thumb.
Maybe if he'd been less quarrelsome, the Yard would have welcomed Mr. Foles' cooperation in their early fingerprinting work, but now he took his chance to try to rubbish Inspector Collins' findings.
11 points of agreement? Nonsense. The inner ridges are scrawled much heavier on the bloody print, for instance. The two outer ridges are thin and closer together than Alfred Stratton's print.
May I pass the exhibit to the jury, Mallard?
Do so by all means, Mr. Porter.
Observe the differences, gentlemen of the jury. They are quite clear. In fact, you will probably see more than 11 points of disagreement between these prints than agreement.
Foles continued to cast doubt on the prosecution's evidence, as if he'd been personally insulted by it. The jury studied the enlargements and were probably confused by what they saw. Then Muir, for the prosecution, put Inspector Collins on the stand, but only to ask a few innocuous questions. He left him to Porter to cross-examine for the defence.
Inspector Collins, do you not agree that these enlargements are at variance in a number of ways?
Yes, sir, superficially.
Superficially? I'd like you to explain that to me.
Well, sir, it's like this. It's all a matter of pressures. A print will appear different depending on the pressure applied by the fingers to a surface. Little pressure will result in the ridges and whorls showing thin. Heavier pressure will thicken these, but it won't alter the structure of the fingerprint, if you get my meaning.
So you will claim still that the two thumbprints we have here are the same?
I do.
Essentially the same?
Yes. I believe the bloody thumbprint was made with the hand grasping the cash box fiercely. The other print was taken at the station, the hand placed on the pad without force.
So are you suggesting that all prints for identification should be taken with equal force?
No. Would you allow me to demonstrate my point?
Demonstrate how, Inspector Collins?
By taking the jury's prints at various pressures.
Do you agree, Mallard?
It's irregular, but I see nothing against it. Have you the necessary equipment, Mr. Collins?
The Times of the following day had a headline, Jury's Fingerprints Taken. What Collins did was to make each of the 12 men and True, there were no women jurors then, place fingers and thumbs first on the ink pad and then on the paper, first lightly, then with pressure, and finally with heavy pressure, as if gripping something forcefully. The results were compelling. This must have left the defence stunned, but they still had another witness up their sleeve, a well-known classifier of fingerprints who'd invented a system of identifying subjects all his own, Dr. J.G. Garson.
I'm not sure how Scotland Yard can totally justify their verdict by these two enlarged photographs. My classification of the prints of the 10 digits is divided into categories. The manual worker, who leaves an uneven print owing to the manner in which he uses his hands. The office worker, such as clerks and bank cashiers. These have even, clear prints. Then we have those of the artistic temperament, artists, writers, painters, musicians. Although when it comes to the professional pianist, his prints are as uneven as the manual worker. However, one does not expect a pianist to be engaging in criminal activity. But all of these, along with doctors, have highly complicated prints. Surgeons are another matter, of course, having strong, hard prints.
This rigmarole was eventually brought to a halt by the judge, who remarked it had little to do with the case he was trying, and he gave the witness to Muir for cross-examination. Mr. Muir began by holding up a letter.
This letter, Dr. Garson, did you write it?
Letter? What letter?
It bears your signature. See for yourself. You did write it, did you not?
Yes, of course I did.
Mallard,
This letter was addressed to the prosecution, dated the 10th of April, some 3 weeks before this trial began. In it, Dr. Garson expresses his willingness to appear as an expert witness for the Crown in this case.
I meant to be an independent witness.
You are a thoroughly unreliable and untrustworthy witness. You will stand down, Dr. Garson.
I wrote the letter with the best intentions.
Stop, thou fool, bleeding fingerprints. No. You did it, Alf. I didn't. What? You bastard.
Quiet,
bloody thumbprint. It ain't right. He made me do it, you worship, the Robin, but he bashed their heads in.
Silence, then. Silence in court.
Take no notice of him, your lordship. He was never near the shop, that I swear.
Yes, we were, but just to do a blag, you said.
Shut up, will you? He's gone crazy, your lordship.
It was your temper, Elf. You bashed them too hard.
Use your hand. Give me some help, somebody. Take them down.
Elf.
Take them down.
Hand him to the sponge units. I never saw none of them.
What, no sponge units?
Have mercy, your worship. I never did murder.
We never did nothing. We've been stitched up.
I swear on my old mother's grave, I never bashed a thing!
Can't hang us on one bloody thumbprint!
Alfred and Albert Stratton were hanged at Pentonville on the 23rd of May, 1905. Fingerprints had come of age.
In The Bloody Thumbprint, Nicholas Murchie played Alfred Stratton and Jonathan Taffler played Albert Stratton. Other parts were played by Jonathan Adams, John Church, Timothy Carlton, Terence Edmund, Ronald Herdman, Peter Penry-Jones, Anne Windsor, John Webb and Melanie Hudson. Murder Most Foul was written by Frederick Bradnam and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Tessa Watt. Thank you.